Okay, good. There's a woman who asked to make a quick announcement. And by the way, if any of you are involved in campus organizations or other activities and you want to make an announcement for the class, that's fine at the beginning of each class after our meditation. So take it away.
All right, can I get everyone's attention, please? We're handing out some blue cards real quick here. If you guys want to start filling those out, that'd be great. My name is Cassie. I'm here to talk to you guys about the Summer Management Program. It's an internship that focuses on leadership, communication, project management, and problem-solving skills. It is open to all ages and majors, so go ahead, fill out those cards. We'll be collecting them in these two aisles here, so just pass them in a bit here. We were rated in the top 100 internships nationwide by the Princeton Review for two different reasons. The first one being our selectivity. We actually only accept between 3 and 5% of all of our applicants. The second reason is that we are a fully paid internship. Our average intern in Wisconsin last year made a little over $10,000. So like I said, if you are interested, go ahead, fill out those cards, pass them in. We'll be around to collect them. We also will take any extras. If we feel like you're qualified, we'll give you a call within the next couple weeks here to give you some more information. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Couple of announcements from me. First, I want to be sure everybody understands what the point of office hours are, especially for new students. You don't have to have some burning question about the material that you feel with a high threshold before you come to see me. It's fine to come to my office hours, the open office hours, just because you want to chat and for me to get to know you a little better, for you to get to know me a little better. We can talk about material in the class. We can talk about other courses you're doing. I absolutely don't mind being used as an informal advisor if you have some issues around your program, around alternatives, things you're thinking about. Just treat this as an opportunity to drop by and see me. I really hope that many of you take advantage of it. Sometimes I have office hours and nobody shows up, and it makes me feel unloved. So, no, seriously, just really take advantage. Don't feel like your identity has to be of one of those pushy students who's always out to meet professors. You can be a shy and retiring student who's very hesitant, and I still would like you to come to my office hours. Take me up on it. Secondly, just to remind you, the annual sociocultural bike tour of Madison will be this Saturday. You don't need to have a bike because we start at a bike store where you can rent bikes cheaply. You don't have to be an avid biker. The first segment is very flat. It's a little bit more demanding if you want to go on the whole trip, but the first part that is through central Madison and out to Old Brick Gardens is pretty flat. So I really encourage you to come. It's also a nice chance to informally meet other students, some grad students, some other faculty come, and also learn something about Madison. Finally, I'd like to make a correction from a side comment I made in the last lecture. I stated in the discussion about the value of democracy and my stance towards it, I made as a side comment that on these various kinds of indexes of democraticness of countries, that the United States ranked, I think I said 25th or 30th. I hadn't checked that ranking before I made the comment, so when I got back to my office, I checked the ranking in one of the prominent sources that does this sort of thing, and it's actually 19th. Now, it's not that big a difference, 19th or 25th. It's 19th out of the 25 countries that are considered full democracies. And I had just inverted the numerator and denominator, so to speak. This raises an issue, though, of a methodological sort. I will give you lots of statistics during this semester. I'm often quoting data. I make mistakes. This is an example. This is an example of a mistake that didn't really matter in one sense. You know, your basic sense, are we at the top of the heap among democratic countries? No, we're towards the bottom among the in the democratic world in our degree of democraticness. But I do think it matters that for every single number I give you, I have a source that I consider a highly reliable source, not a source on the web in some blog. These are all the data comes from very serious research. But occasionally I will either make a mistake in misreporting the data, or the source could be wrong. So I think you should take the numbers I give you seriously. They're not just opinions, they're real data. But if you're skeptical, I invite you to check it out, to look for other sources, to check out the sources that are in the book, and to get a feel for how numbers work by not simply taking them for granted. There's a couple of leftover things from the last lecture that I didn't get to, which I want to at least briefly talk about. For those of you who will be looking at the podcast, periodically at the beginning of one lecture, I'll finish up the previous one because there's some bits that got left off. I will put those with the previous class, not this class, just so each class has its full podcast material in that place. There are two things I wanted to just mention. These are all, I don't remember if these are completely in the chapter or not. The first has to do with how to think about the fact that you're taking a course from someone who has a very strong political perspective. What does that really mean? What does it mean for me to bring to this class a highly critical perspective that's on the left wing of the political spectrum? And why should you bother taking such a course if you strongly disagree with that perspective? Now, I assume that many of you don't share my particular political views. There's no reason why you should. Why should you bother taking such a course? Okay, I have three points to make about this. First, I think it's crucial that an undergraduate education involve diversity of perspectives and points of view, but I don't think that means that every single course needs to be fully balanced in its points of view. The crucial thing is that your education be balanced, not that every single course be balanced. You've all been deeply exposed to the standard views and defenses of American institutions. You've all grown up in the era of the triumph of free markets, where free market ideology is the dominant way that people think about how an economy should be run. This course will give you a different perspective. It will contribute to a balanced view in your life, even if the course doesn't give equal time to all perspectives. So one way to think about this is a way of rebalancing your overall exposure to different ideas, even though within the course itself it won't be completely balanced. Now, I will, throughout the course, give serious attention to alternative perspectives. And I won't, in general, simply ridicule, well, I hope I never ridicule alternative perspectives. I'll take them seriously and make arguments for why I think they are in error, why they make mistakes. But it is the case that I will be spending much more time elaborating my perspective on these matters than I will be in elaborating in detail the alternatives. That's my first point. The second point, and this is a more subtle issue, so you really have to think about this. There's a difference between organizing a course from a particular perspective and presenting biased or distorted information in support of that perspective. To the very best of my ability, every fact and observation and claim I present in this course will be accurate. You should hold me to the highest standards of truth with respect to the material I present. And as I said, I will make mistakes. It's impossible not to make mistakes. But I'll try very hard to achieve the highest possible standards of factual objectivity. I'll also try to present with what I consider on the basis of considerable study and research, some of which is my research, some of which is research of other scholars, to present the most cogent and coherent interpretations of the facts that I present. This doesn't mean that my arguments are beyond criticism. It's not just that I may make mistakes on facts. Some of my arguments using those facts may have errors in them. I assume that I am not a Mr. Know-it-all, and that many of the things which I believe to be true will turn out on further scrutiny to need correction. But this is not the same as a course that's biased. That is, I don't believe it is the case that because of my political perspective, I select only those facts which fit my arguments. Some of you, if you go on in sociology and read some of my own research work, one of its characteristics is that in my research, I always point out where I feel I'm on shaky grounds, where I feel my own research doesn't fully support my arguments. And I think that's one of the crucial things that makes for good social science, good scientific research, is that you don't cover up the flaws in your own research. You try to make them as clear as possible in the hope that somebody might rescue you. So the second general point is, the course has a perspective, but I don't believe that the fact that I have a perspective implies that the course is biased in the presentation of the material, in the facts that you'll be exposed to. Finally, for those of you who are really strongly object to the perspective, who really don't agree with this critical stance towards core American institutions, who locate yourself on the more conservative end of the political spectrum, I ask of you patience and a willingness to try to understand my arguments. I don't mean you have to agree with them. You can end up rejecting my perspective. That's totally fine. But you'll gain something in the sophistication of your own views about your own arguments if you fully understand what I have to say. You can use me as a kind of foil to sharpen your own self-defense of your perspectives. So there will be plenty of you, I am sure, who enter the class on the conservative end of the political perspective and who will leave the class on that end of the perspective. That's fine. I hope you'll end up being a more sophisticated conservative because you understand the nature of the arguments that you're arguing against in a deeper and more systematic way. All right, that's one of the leftovers from the first lecture. The second is a section in the chapter which is about what does it mean to approach something sociologically. I imagine for most of you this is your first sociology course. How many people have ever taken a sociology course? Yeah, so that looks like about 20% of the class. So for most of you, this is your first exposure to this intellectual enterprise called sociology. So I thought, as I worked through this course over the years, I thought, how can I boil down this whole field of sociology to some central, pithy principles that virtually all sociologists would share and which defines what's distinctive about this as an intellectual activity? There are many ways you can do this. There are many different ways of saying, okay, what's the bottom line of sociology? But here's one way of doing it which I find particularly useful. The core idea is simple. Rules govern actions. It's not a very catchy slogan, but rules govern actions can be thought of as the core insight, I think, of much of sociology. You are all conscious thinking persons. I hope you're conscious thinking persons. I'm sure you are. We all make choices. We act with purposes and intentions. This is part of what it means to be a human being. We all experience our lives as, in some sense, self-directed. We're not robots. when you go about your daily life doing things, you see those things that you do as being driven by internal motives, intentions, purposes, and choices. And that's true. You're not robots. But how we act, what we do, what we choose, all of these are governed by rules. They're all governed by rules. You are not an autonomous entity that acts freely in an environment which is ungoverned by constraints. And these constraints can be thought of as the rules that shape your behavior, even though within those rules you make choices. There are six basic sociological ideas about social rules. Six that I think are especially important. I like to list things. This will drive some of you nuts. Other people will find this a useful way of approaching learning things. It's a characteristic of the way I write to say, now there are three of X and there's seven of Y. And six sociological rules, six ways to think about rules. Let me just briefly go through each of these. First, rules are enforced. A rule isn't a rule if there are no consequences whatsoever for breaking the rule. This applies to all sorts of things, dress codes. If any of you came to class in a bikini today, you know, if you just walked in here as if you were coming off of the beach in a bikini, there'd be all sorts of consequences. Even if you weren't forced out, you know, if you walked in here, you'd get a lot of stares, you'd get a lot of buzz, you'd be made to feel really awkward. What have you done? You have violated a dress code. A dress code is a rule. Most of us don't have to decide every morning, oh my God, am I going to wear a bikini to class? No, you know, you've internalized the rule, it's natural, it doesn't bug you that you don't get to wear certain things in public spaces. The dress codes in universities have changed dramatically in the course of my academic lifetime. In the 60s, when I was an undergraduate, there would never be a student in a class wearing shorts, just even on a hot day. And there would be a huge binary division between the way guys and girls, the way men and women would dress. You know, I'm looking casually around the room. There's a lot of androgynous dressing in the classroom. That is, you know, basically the things you're wearing, for many of you, aren't highly sex-typed as to what a man and what a woman will wear. A lot of you are wearing t-shirts with Badger slogans on them. Well, that's a big change in dress codes. That means a change in rules. You still make choices, but the rules have changed. That's the first point. Rules are enforced. Second point, there are many different kinds of rules. Laws, norms, conventions. Conventions are things like driving on the right side of the road. It's enforced by the law, but it's really just a convention. The law is kind of ratifies a convention. We have lots of conventions as to how we should behave. We also have lots of norms. Norms are these codes that you internalize. Internalized self-enforcement is a crucial aspect of the way rules work. Things that we call embarrassment and guilt are the way rules are enforced by oneself, on oneself. If you do something that you and other people see it and you're embarrassed, the fact that you feel embarrassment indicates that there's a rule you violated. If you feel guilty, not just embarrassed, it implies that the rule in question has a moral weight, not just a convention. Third point, rules are not neutral. There are winners and losers. Now we're now getting into the thick of things. Rules don't just make our lives easy by coordinating our activity, by making us comfortable in a physical space. You know, we're all comfortable in what we're wearing because we're all conforming to rules and we don't have to worry about it. There are rules, however, that are not neutral. They create advantages and disadvantages. Let me give you an example of this that I think is a telling one, but which doesn't have a lot of political baggage with it. Think about changes over time in the rules of basketball. It used to be against the rules of basketball to touch the rim of the basket. So it used to be the case that if you did a slam dunk, the basket would not count because you touched the rim. Now you can see why the game became way more interesting to watch once you could touch the rim. You know, the slam dunk is one of the great, beautiful things in basketball. But it did create a change in the advantages and disadvantages. It made height more important. Height always mattered in basketball. But the advantage that a person has just from how far off the ground they are without jumping yet, that increased once you could touch the rim. That rule, therefore, isn't neutral. If this is a case where most people think, well, that's no big deal. There are lots of rules where the non-neutrality of the rules, the fact that they advantage someone over others, really does matter. It has consequences for how people live their lives. I mentioned last time that I felt it was unfair, an unfair advantage, that parents can spend lots of money to get their kids tutored in taking SAT tests. And that the research indicates that if you do one of these intensive tutorings, it raises your scores 150 or 200 points. Well, that's a rule. We could have a rule where that would not be allowed. You could simply say you cannot have test preparation classes. And you'd have to have various kinds of mechanisms to enforce that. Well, that would be probably a bad rule under the circumstances in our society. It would be seen as a huge infringement on people's rights. But the absence of that rule creates advantages. It's not neutral. Allowing parents to do that is not neutral. It means some children are advantaged in taking tests over others. Fourth point, rules are backed by power. Rules don't continue just by inertia. They are backed by power. But power itself is governed by rules. Now this gets really complicated. Rules are backed by power, but power itself is organized by rules. We have what's called a recursive system. Everything affects everything. The rules shape the power backs the rules. The rules shape the power back the rules. Power is rule-based, but power defends the rules. So you can see why you end up not just with a collection of rules, but a system of rules as a result. Rules are backed by power. When social rules impose considerable benefits on some people and deprivations on others, if you have a rule that helps some people and harms others, those rules will be stable when they also confer power on the people they benefit. Think of slavery. I mean, let's think of a really clear example. Slavery is a system governed by rules in which some people own others and control their lives from top to bottom. Slavery is a system of rules, but it's backed by power. The slave owner doesn't merely own the slave. The slave owner's power is backed by the slave state, which the slave owners control. Now you can see why that's crucial. You couldn't really have a slave system where you gave the vote to slaves. You know, just imagine, how long would a system of slavery last if the political power was organized on a one person, one vote basis, where the slaves could vote? It wouldn't last at all. The necessary condition for slavery is that the rules that govern slavery were backed by a system of power controlled by the people who benefited from slavery. That's a clear and simple case. But it's part of a general problem, a general issue. Rules are backed by power. The power is itself governed by rules. This quickly gets really complicated, as you can see, because of the interdependency. But it's an important way just to think about this. We have rules. The rules aren't neutral. Non-neutral rules will be stable when they also confer power on the beneficiaries of those rules. fifth point, more complexity. Rules are often inconsistent. We don't live in a beautifully fine-tuned world where all the rules that govern our lives all fit together in some seamless web. No, the rules under which we live at times become extremely inconsistent. A good example of this, which we will explore in some detail towards the middle of the semester, concerns rules governing gender relations. There are considerable inconsistencies in the nature of the norms and expectations and rules that govern how men and women interact with each other, how their roles are defined, how their identities are defined and connect. This causes havoc in people's lives. The rules that govern gender have evolved over centuries and centuries in our culture, and suddenly the nature of those relations has been radically transformed in an historically unprecedented way, and the rules haven't caught up to the transformations in the actual relationships. So I have female academic colleagues who feel terrible binds between different expectations about how they should behave, what they should do, how they should organize their time, in their capacity as academics, in their capacity as mothers, in their capacity as women in the world. Gender rules are really confused these days, and it causes stress. It's much simpler when everything lines up in the same way. Some sociologists have referred to this as gender vertigo, kind of a dizzying transformation of the rules that govern gender relations. Rules are inconsistent. It's a good thing, I think, that rules can be inconsistent, because that's one of the things that allows for change. If all the rules tightly reinforce each other and they all fit together, it's much tougher when you don't like the rules to figure out how can you change them. When there are inconsistency and contradictions and tensions, that provides a lever for getting inside of this game of rules and trying to do something about it. And this leads to the sixth point. Rules change over time. We live in a world of social rules, but those rules aren't fixed. They change, sometimes by deliberate efforts. When you have a social struggle to change laws, those are struggles with a deliberate purpose of changing certain kinds of rules. Other times, rules change just by slow, incremental evolution, operating often in a way behind the backs of people. The change in dress codes over the last 40 years in universities, that was a change that did not occur with some abrupt break. It occurred because people began to violate the rules, and people saw that violating the rules didn't actually create much controversy, and so more people started violating the rules. And now we have a very different kind of much more relaxed dress code than we did in the past. All of this bears on how we are going to approach the material in this course. Much of what we are going to be studying are the rules by which American society works. When the subtitle of the course is How It Really Works, what that means is what are the real rules that govern the way our institutions function and our lives are organized within those institutions. We're going to be looking at how they really work, looking for the tensions and contradictions in these rules, and thinking about the ways in which we might want to change them. Okay, that's the leftover from the last lecture, and I will